SpaceX's Starship suffers another setback, Firefly lands on the moon, but other companies don't have as much luck with their missions, and did a Chinese rocket blow up again on the pad? What's up with all the bad news this week? As always, we've got all that and more coming up this week in Spaceflight. Okay, while there wasn't a ton of good news this week, the first story was definitely a success. On March 2nd at 8:34 UTC, Firefly's Blue Ghost Lander became the first privately developed spacecraft to successfully land on the moon, and also in an upright position. And you'll see why we had to put in that qualifier in just a bit. For the first time since the 1970s, the US now has a lunar lander on the moon working and operating successfully on its surface, and it didn't suffer any issues on landing. We've been following Blue Ghost's journey to the moon in previous episodes, but let's go through a quick recap. Blue Ghost launched atop a Falcon 9 on January 15th, which dropped it off in a high Earth orbit, where it spent a few weeks performing system checkouts and commissioning its payloads. On February 8th, it was finally time to leave Earth behind to head for the moon, and Blue Ghost performed its translunar injection burn. The lander arrived in lunar orbit on February 13th and took some amazing pictures on its way there. Now, it was just a matter of waiting for the right sunlight conditions at the landing site. Firefly wanted to make the most out of the lunar day, so Blue Ghost had to wait until the sun rose over its landing site to get down to the surface. Well, that moment finally arrived on March 2nd. The lander first inserted itself into a descent orbit that brought Blue Ghost down to 20 kilometers above the lunar surface. Then at that point, it ignited its engines once more to initiate descent. Less than 2 minutes before touchdown, the lander intentionally shut off its main engine and continued to descend under its reaction control thrusters. These slowed Blue Ghost down further until it touched down softly on the rim of a small crater. This was a truly impressive feat, made even more remarkable by the fact that this was Firefly's very first shot at it. Then Blue Ghost and its payloads got to work immediately. In just 2 days, the lander sent back 20 gigabytes of data, among which were some stunning landing videos. All 10 of NASA's payloads are operational on the lunar surface, and 8 of them have already met their mission objectives. Firefly plans to continue operating the payloads throughout the rest of the lunar day, making the most of the available sunlight. Congratulations to Firefly and NASA on this massive success. Blue Ghost's companion on launch, iSpace's Hakuto R lander named Resilience, is still on its way to the moon, but it's taking the long way round. It's using a so-called low energy transfer to get there, taking it all the way to 1.1 million kilometers from Earth. Now, believe it or not, this saves a lot of propellant, but it comes at a cost of taking longer. Much longer. After Resilience successfully completed its deep space maneuver this week, iSpace announced that the lander is now scheduled to enter lunar orbit on May 6th. If all goes well, it'll attempt to land on the moon on June 5th at 1924 UTC. Last week, another lander launched on its way to the moon, a lander named Athena from Intuitive Machines. This was the company's second attempt to land on the moon after its first mission toppled over after touchdown. So, how did Athena do? Well, it attempted to land on the lunar surface on March 6th, around 1730 UTC, but as time went by, we didn't get confirmation of successful landing. The initial report suggested that Athena was upright, but that its engine was still firing long after it should have landed. Definitely not what was expected. So engineers in mission control scrambled to get even more data. A few hours later, Intuitive Machines CEO Steve Altemus explained the situation during a press briefing.
I do have to tell you that we don't believe we're in the correct attitude on the surface of the moon yet again. I don't have all the data yet to say exactly what the attitude of the vehicle is. We're collecting photos now and downlinking those, and we're going to get a picture from the Lunar Reconnaissance Orbiter camera from above, from orbit, and we'll confirm that over the coming days as we get that data down.
But the mission's fate became clear within a day after landing. Athena had touched down 250 meters from its intended landing site, and a picture confirmed that it ended up on its side. Athena's batteries are now depleted, and in its current orientation, the lander's solar panels won't be able to generate enough power to recharge. As a result, Intuitive Machines declared the mission over. There is a sliver of good news, though. Intuitive Machines was able to speedrun some payload milestones while Athena still had power, so some of the payloads might still have returned useful data. Intuitive Machines will attempt to land its next mission, IM-3, early next year. Hopefully that one will not only land, but also stay upright. Unfortunately, it seems that two other missions that launched together as a rideshare with IM-2 suffered an even worse fate. NASA provided a small satellite called Lunar Trailblazer, which was supposed to study water on the lunar surface to help future human missions to the moon find water sources. Sadly, NASA lost contact with the satellite shortly after launch. Based on radar observations and the last telemetry that Lunar Trailblazer sent back, it seems that the spacecraft is slowly spinning and low on power. Because of this, it couldn't perform its planned trajectory correction maneuvers. The engineers are now trying to re-establish contact with the spacecraft and are looking for other ways to put Lunar Trailblazer into the correct orbit. Hopefully these attempts will be successful, because otherwise, it won't be much of a trailblazer after all. Astroforge's Odin spacecraft also shared the same ride into space, with its own plan to fly by the moon and then make its way to asteroid 2022 OB5 under its own propulsion. But issues arose shortly after launch for this vehicle, when Astroforge had trouble contacting Odin. The company still did manage to contact the spacecraft multiple times, but it ultimately just wasn't meant to be. Later in the week, Astroforge published an extensive overview of what went wrong. The mission started off with several known issues, which already reduced the mission's chance of success from the get-go. Astroforge experienced more issues after launch, including unexpected problems with ground stations. But even so, none of these issues should have spelled the end of the mission. Astroforge has two hypotheses for what might have put the final nail in the coffin. There could have been problems with solar panel deployment, or alternatively, the spacecraft might be tumbling. In the latter case, Astroforge might still be able to contact Odin again when its antenna is pointed at Earth. In the weeks leading up to Starship's Flight 8, we've mentioned multiple times here at NSF that the plan for this mission was the same one that SpaceX had for Starship's 7th flight. But what we didn't expect was for Flight 8 to literally follow that to the letter and happen pretty much exactly like Flight 7 did. But let's rewind a bit to what happened in the week leading up to the flight. Over the weekend, SpaceX moved Ship 34 out to the launch site for lifting and stacking onto Booster 15 ahead of flight. The company attempted a first launch attempt for this flight on Monday, March 3rd, and while it initially seemed like everything was going well on the count, the teams found issues regarding the booster that needed some attention. A hold was called at T-40 seconds, and the count was held for a few minutes as they cleared that booster issue and another issue that had happened on the ship as well. The hold was lifted after a few minutes, but after the clock resumed its ticking, automated checks halted the count once again, even before the flight director could give their go for launch. SpaceX scrubbed the launch for the day, and over the following days worked on getting both vehicles and the launch pad set and ready for another attempt. Ship 34 was de-stacked, and teams went up to its engine section to work on the ship before restacking it on Booster 15 on Wednesday, March 5th. With both vehicles stacked, SpaceX again went into launch preparations and countdown for Starship Flight 8. After a brief hold at T-40 seconds, liftoff of Starship took place on March 6th at 2330 UTC, clearing the pad a few seconds later and heading to the east over the Gulf. The rocket, powered by 33 Raptor engines, continued and performed its hot staging maneuver nominally once again. The booster performed its flip and boost back burn, and while two engines didn't light during the maneuver, it still was cleared to go back to the launch site for a landing attempt. That landing burn also had one engine out, but Super Heavy once again demonstrated its engine out capability by successfully sliding itself between the chopstick arms and landing on their landing rails. This was the third time a Super Heavy booster has been successfully recovered, and the first time that it happened while not igniting all 13 Raptor engines during the landing burn. But as you all probably know, the booster is just the first stage. The stage that does all the work in space is the ship, and in the case of Flight 8, that was Ship 34. Ship 34 successfully ignited its six engines during hot staging, and it had to execute a burn that was roughly 6 minutes in duration to achieve its suborbital trajectory out to the Indian Ocean. Now, it was during this burn that Ship 33, the one from Flight 7, was lost, so it was critical for Ship 34 to successfully move through that phase and achieve its orbital trajectory. Unfortunately, 34 suffered a very similar fate to 33. Nearly 8 minutes after launch, multiple engines started to go out with some rather violent venting seen on the onboard cameras. Unlike on Flight 7, where all of the feeds just cut off as engines were shutting down, this time the feed was somewhat stable, and the ship kept transmitting video even as it lost attitude control and spun end over end. The camera feeds eventually ended roughly 9.5 minutes into flight, and SpaceX commentators Dan Hewitt and Kate Tice confirmed what was obvious to everyone, which was that Ship 34 had been lost. The loss of Ship 34 was very reminiscent of Ship 33's loss, with the difference being that this time the engines were actually lost more abruptly, and we also had onboard views as it all happened. After the flight, SpaceX updated its website with information about the flight, indicating that, quote, prior to the end of the ascent burn, an energetic event in the aft portion of Starship resulted in the loss of several Raptor engines. This in turn led to a loss of attitude control and ultimately a loss of communications with Starship. Now this is basically what we all saw on the SpaceX stream during the flight, and there didn't seem to be any extra news from this statement, but we'll obviously keep an eye on any updates as they become available. The ship eventually broke apart in space, and pieces of it re-entered over the Caribbean, just like on Flight 7. Many people reached out to us and sent in their footage of this re-entry, which was even seen from the Space Coast in Florida. So thank you to them and everyone else who let us use their footage, because it's definitely appreciated and it helps us to tell this story. Also after the flight, the FAA confirmed that it was indeed requiring a mishap investigation by SpaceX into what happened on Flight 8. The agency also confirmed that it had activated a debris response area as a result of the incident, slowing aircraft outside of the area or stopping them before departing on their flights. The FAA additionally ordered ground stops at some major airports like Orlando International Airport, but the restrictions were lifted shortly thereafter, some lasting less than half an hour. Now, it's worth pointing out that things already looked off several seconds before what SpaceX calls an energetic event in the aft portion of Starship. If we rewind to approximately 7 minutes and 45 seconds into the flight, we can see a feed of the engine section, and a few things looked off compared to how it looked earlier in the flight. For example, right away, we can see that the camera seems to have some sort of an orange hue on its feed, almost as if there might have been a fire in the engine bay. We can also see through the telemetry display at the bottom how there seems to be some venting coming from that area that wasn't there before. On top of this, towards the left of the screen, there's what appears to be an orange glow on the methane cooling line of the Raptor vacuum engine. It's not clear whether this was because it was reflecting the orange from the fire or because it was just simply getting hot. Either way, it does seem like there were a few events that preceded the abrupt and violent loss of engines on Ship 34, and that may have contributed to such an outcome. This was definitely not the ending that we all wanted, and of course, one that SpaceX didn't want either. It's now the second time in a row that this has happened, and frankly, it kinda hurts. We all want Starship to succeed, of course, and setbacks are always part of the path to success, but having two of them like this in a row, it's not a great feeling. To all the teams working on this program, we feel you. Let's all hope for a better outcome on Flight 9, and we'll be following along as always. Now we'll take a look at some other stories across space, starting with incidents during transport. This week, NASA reported that a shipping container containing a Cygnus pressurized cargo module was damaged in shipping. The Cygnus was supposed to launch to the ISS in June for a cargo resupply mission, but depending on the extent of the damage, that launch might be delayed. Teams from NASA and Northrop Grumman will now inspect the module to see if it sustained any damage. Hopefully, the damage is limited to just the shipping container, and Cygnus itself gets away unscathed. Nevertheless, the damage did prompt NASA to pack extra food and other consumables into the upcoming SpaceX resupply mission in April. This, of course, was done as an abundance of caution, as the station does already have enough backup supplies to last many months, so the astronauts won't run out of food anytime soon, but it's always better to be safe than sorry. China's Tiangong Space Station is expecting an international visitor. This week, China and Pakistan signed an agreement to cooperate on sending a Pakistani astronaut to Tiangong. This will be the first time an international astronaut visits the Chinese station. However, the astronaut won't participate in a full-duration mission, rather only a visit for a short stay. All recent missions to Tiangong have been long-duration missions, so we've yet to see how this shorter one will actually be scheduled. One option is to bring the Pakistani astronaut up on a regular crew rotation flight and then have them hitch a ride back down with the returning crew capsule, requiring one of the Chinese astronauts to stay on the station for much longer. Similar crew rotations have been performed on the International Space Station, so it's not unthinkable that China might do that as well. Alternatively, China might just launch a dedicated short-term mission. But before any of that can happen, China and Pakistan need to select astronauts first. Under the current plan, this selection process is expected to take a year, and once completed, the astronauts will be trained in China in preparation for their flight. We received some bad news about NASA's Twin Voyager spacecraft this week. As the two continue to travel through interstellar space, their power supplies are dwindling. So to conserve power, NASA has been turning off more and more of their science instruments. On February 25th, engineers turned off the Cosmic Ray Subsystem Experiment on Voyager 1, and Voyager 2's low-energy charged particle instrument awaits the same fate on March 24th. After this, both Voyagers will only be operating 3 out of their 10 science instruments, and they should be able to continue like that for another year. Then, NASA expects to shut off another instrument on both spacecraft to conserve even more power. While it's sad to see these venerable spacecraft decay, both of them have been traveling through space for an amazing 47 years, making them the oldest active NASA missions. Even at their reduced capacities, the Voyagers are still doing valuable science, and will continue to do so for as long as they can. The European Space Agency's Integral Gamma Ray Telescope took its last observations this week. The telescope launched in 2002 and has been observing the universe ever since, more specifically, studying the gamma ray bursts that result from the universe's most powerful events. It had to go to space to do this because Earth's atmosphere blocks these gamma rays, making it impossible to observe them from the ground. There are two types of gamma ray bursts. Long bursts are the result of massive stars collapsing when they go supernova. Short bursts, on the other hand, are caused by black holes and neutron stars colliding. Integral caught roughly 20 of these short bursts per year, and some of these coincided with gravitational waves, which helped scientists study these events in much more detail. After 22 years of scouring the sky for gamma rays, Integral has now stopped collecting data. In order to prevent space debris, in 2015, ESA even planned ahead and had it fire a special burn to get the satellite into a gradually decaying orbit. Integral is now expected to find its demise on re-entry into Earth's atmosphere in early 2029. Something happened at China's Zhoushan Satellite Launch Center this week, and it wasn't a launch. On March 1st, a rocket was supposed to lift off from Launch Site 95, but shortly after the scheduled T0, rumors started that things might not have gone to plan. Apparently, the rocket exploded on the pad right before liftoff. Unfortunately, we haven't received any official information on what happened. We don't even know for sure which rocket was involved, but based on what we've heard, it's most likely a Kuizhou 1A from the state-owned rocket company X-Pace. Attempts to analyze the damage with satellite images have been inconclusive too. There seems to be something on the pad, but radar images of the pad show no signs of debris, so damage might have been limited. But regardless, we know for sure that there wasn't a launch at the planned time. Another launch that was supposed to take off from the same pad a few days later was also postponed indefinitely. So it sure seems that something didn't go to plan, but we've just got to wait for more information on what went down at Zhoushan this week. Now let's take a look at the space traffic of the week and see what's coming up next week in spaceflight. We're starting off the week on Mars. Okay, maybe not on Mars, but 884 kilometers from its surface, because that is where NASA's Europa Clipper spacecraft flew by the red planet on March 1st at 1757 UTC. It was only a short encounter, as the spacecraft whizzed past the planet at 24.5 kilometers per second. Now, the reason for this flash visit was so that it could use the Martian gravity to change its trajectory around the sun. As the spacecraft passed by, Mars's gravitational pull slowed down Europa Clipper's velocity by 2 kilometers per second. This move is therefore known as a gravity assist. Europa Clipper is now on a trajectory to pass by Earth in December 2026 for another gravity assist that will put it on a path to intercept Jupiter's orbit in April of 2030. While it'll take years before Europa Clipper gets to study the Jovian moon, mission scientists took the Mars flyby as an opportunity to test the spacecraft's thermal imagers and radar instrument. Back on Earth, we had a Soyuz launch on March 2nd. The rocket lifted off from Plesetsk in Russia at 2222 UTC, carrying a new navigation satellite into medium Earth orbit. This was the second next-generation GLONASS K2 satellite, bringing enhanced accuracy to the Russian navigation system. We also had a Falcon 9 launch this week. Unsurprisingly, the payload was a batch of Starlink satellites, adding 13 direct-to-cell satellites and 8 normal V2 minis to the constellation. The mission lifted off from Florida on March 3rd at 2:24 Universal Time. The booster for this mission was B-1086, which flew for the fifth time. It landed successfully on the deck of droneship Just Read the Instructions, but sadly misunderstood those instructions as it toppled over after the landing. According to SpaceX, this was due to a post-landing fire that broke one of the legs and eventually led to the loss of the booster. When the droneship returned to port, it became clear that there wasn't much left of it. The poor thing even seemed to have partially melted in the fire, and only its engine section appeared relatively intact. With this mission, SpaceX has launched a total of 8,060 Starlink satellites, of which 965 have found their way back to Earth and 6,382 have moved into their operational orbits. For the next launch, we go to French Guiana, where Ariane 6 lifted off on its second ever mission. On March 6th, the rocket lit its Vulcan engines, followed by its two side boosters, and lifted off at 16:24 Universal Time. The payload for this mission was a reconnaissance satellite for the French government. The satellite, known as CSO-3, is the third satellite in the Composante Spatiale Optique system, which translates to optical space component. With the addition of this latest satellite, the system is now completed. As mentioned before, this was Ariane 6's second flight and its first operational mission. Unlike on its first flight, this time the auxiliary power unit was able to restart in orbit, and the second stage Vinci engine relit after satellite deployment to bring the stage back down to Earth for disposal. This is an ability that the cryogenic upper stage for Ariane 5 did not have, and a burn that failed on the first flight of Ariane 6. Going into next week, we'll have the launch of NASA's Spectrophotometer for the History of the Universe, Epoch of Reionization and Ices Explorer, or SPHEREx, on March 9th. A Falcon 9 is set to lift the telescope into space from California with four additional small satellites for NASA's Punch mission. These missions were originally slated to launch last week, but were delayed to diagnose some issues with the launch vehicle. If plans hold on the 9th, Falcon 9 is set to lift off at 3:09 UTC. All five satellites in this flight will be deployed into sun-synchronous orbits, and the booster will return to its launch site and land at Landing Zone 4. Shortly after that, another Falcon 9 is expected to lift off from the other side of the country. This time, the payload will be another batch of Starlink direct-to-cell satellites. The four-hour launch window opens on March 9th at 4:10 UTC. We'll also have an Electron launch next week. This mission, dubbed the Lightning God Rains, will launch from Rocket Lab's own launch complex in New Zealand and carry a synthetic aperture radar satellite into low Earth orbit for the Japanese company IQPS. T0 is expected during a two-hour launch window starting on March 10th at midnight UTC. Next up will be a Starlink mission from Florida, launching more direct-to-cell satellites into low Earth orbit. Liftoff is expected during a four-hour window, starting at 12:18 Universal Time on March 11th. Now back to Mars for another flyby. Yes, we just had one last week, but this time it'll be for the European Space Agency's Hera mission. The spacecraft is on its way to asteroid Didymos and its companion Dimorphos, but to get there, it'll have to swing by the red planet on March 12th. Hera will make its closest approach to Mars at 12:50 UTC, at roughly 5,000 kilometers from the planet's surface. What's more, it'll pass even closer to the Martian moon Deimos at a distance of 1,000 kilometers. Back in California, we'll have another Falcon 9 launch. It's the next transporter mission to carry a whole bunch of payloads into space for SpaceX's SmallSat rideshare program. The window for this mission opens on March 12th at 6:39 UTC and lasts 46 minutes. NASA and SpaceX are getting ready for the Crew 10 mission. NASA astronauts Anne McClain and Nicole Ayers, JAXA astronaut Takuya Onishi, and Russian cosmonaut Kirill Peskov are scheduled to ride Dragon to the ISS on March 12th. Liftoff is set for 23:48 UTC from Launch Complex 39A at the Kennedy Space Center. And wrapping up the week, we'll have another Starlink mission on March 13th. This launch will be conducted from the Cape during a four-hour window opening at 20:27 Universal Time. And that's your weekly update of spaceflight news. I'm Alicia Siegel for NSF, and we'll see you all again next week to recap This Week in Spaceflight.